Rising Coaches Podcast is brought to you by Connor Sports, the market leader in sports, athletic, and gym flooring. Connor Sports, where champions play. Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon. We appreciate you tuning in. Today we are joined by Dave Love, shooting coach from the NBA, has worked with the Phoenix Suns, the Oklahoma City Thunder, the Cleveland Cavaliers, and most recently the Orlando Magic. Has also worked years with the Canadian national team, and he joins us to talk about what he looks for and what he teaches when diving into the jump shot. A lot of great content in today's episode, one where I learned a ton. Hope you guys can take a few things from it. And if you are interested in learning more, visit CoachDaveLove.com. He has a newsletter on there with some unbelievable material, very straight to the point, great tidbits that I check out almost on a daily basis to see if it's things that I can take to our team. Hope you enjoy. Coach, we've got you finally.
Perfect.
Thanks for jumping on the podcast. I appreciate you being here and taking the time.
It's a pleasure. I appreciate the invitation.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your background. Obviously, did you grow up playing? Where are you from? How'd you get into coaching?
I grew up in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, which is about as far off the basketball beaten path as you can get. And especially at the time that I got into it, probably not in the top five sports that young people would play. I think it's now eclipsed even hockey as far as the number of kids in the city that will play basketball. But back when I was playing, it wasn't close. A very average high school player that just loved shooting, and I lucked into having a great mentor that taught me a lot about shooting and really just helped me on a career path that I didn't realize was a career path at the time.
Who was your mentor, Coach?
My mentor was Chip Englund, and Chip is the shooting coach for the San Antonio Spurs. I met him back in his playing days. He played for a team in my hometown called the Calgary 88. And I started off just as a fan of that team, and ended up being a ball boy for the team. And that's kind of where my friendship and mentor-mentee relationship with Chip started to blossom.
That's amazing. What were some of the early memories that you recall working with that team and working with Chip?
Nothing really involving basketball. It was all just the memories, the kind of memories that you gain from just being around a team, like just the silly moments that stick in my brain. And Chip was just such a wonderful person, so giving with his time. He would spend a half hour after games just telling stories and telling jokes with the ball boys. So there would be this player surrounded by five or six ball boys just hanging on his every word. He would take us all for a celebratory lunch at the end of the season to say thank you for our help. And so it was all just memories like that, like going for lunch or just rebounding for him before games as he's just making shot after shot after shot. And some of the silly little pranks that you end up playing or being involved in, those are probably the best memories.
Did any of those other ball boys that you worked with go on to have a career in basketball? I feel like a lot of times when you're around somebody at that high level, they tend to have a tree of guys that just blossom everywhere they go.
Well, my boss, who's a fellow by the name of Jeff Harris, went on. He tried to to get into journalism and quickly realized that maybe journalism wasn't where he wanted to be, but he could parlay that background into a front office job. And he's now assistant general manager to a minor league hockey team in Victoria, British Columbia. And I don't think the other fellow was ever a ball boy for the 88s, but he just, a fellow by the name of Kelly Forbes, who I played against in high school, and he and I both ended up assistant coaches at Chip England Summer Camp in Calgary. And Kelly is now an assistant coach in player development with the San Antonio Spurs as well. So they work together on a daily basis now, Kelly and Chip do.
How about that? So what was your first coaching gig?
My first coaching gig probably would have been the what community would they have been? I forget even the name of the community, but it would have been a group of 8 and 9 year olds. The team name was the Snipers. I still remember that part.
Did you get to pick the team name?
No! When they're 8 and 9, that's like the highlight of their season is for them to pick the team name. So
right,
we came up with Snipers somehow, and it was a great. I was probably about 22, and somewhere in that range, and just had decided I'd like to stay involved, and so I'd be a head coach for this this youth group. But I guess even before that. My dad was a high school coach, so my year after high school, I was an assistant for him, which in Canadian high school, there's no money for an assistant coach. It was a volunteer job that I did as much as I possibly could, but I don't even know if I had any responsibilities looking back at it, and then working at Chip Summer Camps as well. So I think the blend... I don't think anybody has like a definitive, this is when I started coaching. It seems to be that you transition slowly from one to the other.
So when did this start becoming a career and less of a hobby coaching the Snipers? How does this transition into, years of working with various NBA teams?
Well, I remained in contact with Chip, and he was really good about giving me advice on what he thought I should do next. And the first piece of advice that he gave was probably when I was about 20, 21, 22, and he had left Calgary by that point. And he said to me, hey, you should start your own summer camps because there aren't really any like good small basketball summer camps. All the camps at that point were just large babysitting camps with the basketball theme. And so he gave me that advice, and it took me a little while to actually take the advice and do something with it. And what I started doing was starting my own shooting camps in 2001. So I think I would have been about 27 years old at that point. And my biggest dream or goal at that point was to be able to make a few hundred extra dollars a month. I was working at a TV station as my full-time job and thought, if I could turn this little business into just something that generates some side revenue, then I get to do something I love and have this little business, which seemed exciting and new to me. And it just kept growing from these camps that I did in my hometown to the camps I did around my province. To working with a university team in my hometown, and then finally one day Chip phoned and said, "Hey, expect to fuck off in the Phoenix Suns."
How about that? All right, I want to back up a little bit. You said you were an average player, but you love to shoot. So I have a question for you. So, do you think you loved to shoot because you always were kind of good at it, or were you good at it because you just loved shooting?
Oh man, that's a great question. I don't know, and I don't think there is one. I think they kind of go hand in hand, where you try something and you have a little success with it, and it makes you feel good about yourself, and so you want to do it more. And then because you've done it more, it makes you a little bit better than everybody else, and it just both sides of that equation keep feeding each other. And then throw into it being exposed to people like Chip England and just seeing what – he could do when he was shooting a basketball, or having Larry Bird as my hero. And while everybody was fascinated with Michael Jordan and dunks, I was enamored with Larry and his ability to shoot the ball, which at that point wasn't really a cool thing to do. So I think all those things kind of fed each other and led me to where I am.
What did you start coaching? You were coaching teams. I'm sure you're doing everything. What led you to just becoming a specialty shooting coach?
I really didn't work with teams. I got into it being a specialty coach or a shooting coach almost right from the beginning. Like, I had that 8 and 9 year olds, and I kind of got to the end of the season and thought, well, that was fun. And then just kept hearing the advice from Skip, hey, you should start your own shooting camp. And like, I looked at the information that players in my area were getting, and they really just, they didn't go much deeper than beef, like bend your knees, elbows in, eyes on target, follow through. And I was sitting on information that went way more in depth than I thought other people were being taught. And so really right from the beginning, I called myself a shooting coach. I didn't really know anybody else within 1,000 miles of me that was doing that. And so I didn't have any competition, and I had the ability to just kind of figure it out in a vacuum. Like, I was left alone to just say, all right, if you're going to call yourself a shooting coach, you have to actually improve a player's ability to shoot. Figure out that and how to make that happen, and there are no rules. And so I kind of invented my own little rules and theories and practices to make that happen, and then started to realize that other people were doing very, very similar things as my scope of the world increased.
So were your camps, I'm just trying to visualize your camps here. This isn't like split up into teams, shirts and skins, just roll out the balls and get it in. You guys were really breaking it down, what, getting like hundreds, thousands of shots up a day?
Yeah. So what it's evolved into now, I'll start with that, is we break down the shots. Typically a camp or a clinic will be 3 hours, and we'll spend an hour on feet, an hour on what I call ball pass and gripping the basketball, and then an hour on follow through. And we'll teach about 5 or 6 specific points within those headings, and just force the kids to hold themselves accountable to trying a new thing and building new habits. Back in the day when I first started the camps, I probably had an hour's worth of information and a 2-hour clinic, and I was just really filling time. I would do 3-person weave or 3-man weave just to fill 15 minutes because I didn't know what else to teach. And as I got better at it, realized that, okay, 3 hours isn't long enough anymore. But it's a nice little introduction. So it's really been an evolution.
You know, it's funny. I was fortunate enough to work for Eddie Johnson. He had camps when he was playing with the Phoenix Suns, or he was retired at this point, but got to work his camps. You know, one of the best shooters of all time, obviously. And, you know, I think some of the kids there just signed up because he was a former Sun player and parents wanted to get him out of the house for a few hours. And Eddie had like no sympathy for that. And it was basically like, all right, welcome to camp. Everybody make 500 shots from the top of the key. So it
right.
was, they got thrown into it real quick. Like, this is not your typical camp, but it was amazing being around somebody that level and just the details and things that he'd work with on them. So let me ask you this. When you start with a kid or, you know, an adult or anybody, what are some of the basics or the immediate things that you look for in their shot, and how do you fix it without overcomplicating?
That's really evolved for me over time. In the beginning, I used to start with a player's feet and really just try and simplify it, like get them on balance and limit the excess movement in their body when they shoot. And I started with that because it was sort of the easiest thing that led to a fairly significant benefit for the player. And as I've gotten better at teaching, I've found that I can now, rather than teaching a player a theory, I'm better at adapting the theory to that particular player. So I can figure out better now what is holding this individual player back. What habit do they have that is limiting their success? And then how can we relearn the new habit that will open up that potential?
What is something that you have to have to be a good shooter? Follow through, feet, balance?
About 5 years ago, I made a transition where I went from thinking about the feet being the most important thing, and I now think they're second. Now I would say grip is number one, and I think it's dramatically overlooked. Like, how you hold the basketball really impacts how well the ball will leave your hand, and if the ball leaves your hand well, then you have a chance to be really consistent. But if you don't grip the ball properly, then you're just limiting that potential for the future.
I'm sure it's easier to show me than tell me, but what's the perfect grip?
I think a few things that go into a perfect grip in my mind would be that your hand is comfortably wide. Like, I want your hand wide enough that you are in control of the basketball and that your fingers aren't very close together, because then it's tough to control the ball no matter how big your hands are. I want the ball sort of into your fingerprint and up off the heel of your hand. How much we want the palm off the ball, that's up for debate, but I'll let players have some comfort level within that. And then I really want to make sure that when they get to their set point, their index finger is on the bottom of the basketball and it's aligned with their target line. So if you imagine a line between the middle of your body and the middle of the hoop, I call that the target line. And I want that index finger up along that target line, parallel to it, if not directly on plane with it.
So if someone's got a messed up grip, what are you doing to retrain that? And how long is that process?
What I do with it is just a bunch of form shooting, putting them in the correct grip. And I have about four or five different little drills that I do that all to the naked eye sort of look like form shooting, but with some subtle differences in there. And you're just forcing them to, okay, this is how you used to do it. It's holding you back. Here's what we can do to unlock some of that potential. Try it. It's uncomfortable. Get into this position, learn to make this move. And so we'll do these versions of form shooting for an hour at a time for potentially weeks and never really graduate out of it. Even when a player starts to really find their own shot and have some success, it's still the first 3 to 5 minutes of a warm-up is just reminding your body of those positions. So I think that's the thing that a lot of players and coaches overlook, is just how slowly or how much you need to isolate a bad habit in order to learn to make it a good habit.
Do you see when they're done with the form shooting, now they step back out to the three-point line, whether it's with you or on their own? I mean, are they going right back to their old habits? Is it getting worse before it gets better?
I find in my job, and where I've really made an improvement in the last 5 to 10 years, is that when I realize that, okay, it's not a matter of me teaching somebody to do something and then expecting they're going to apply it in all settings, but rather that you explain something and then you develop that habit. And so it's not, I'm going to teach you how to grip the basketball and now go out to the three-point line and try and apply what you just learned. But putting them in increasingly more difficult settings to bridge that gap from form shooting to contested step back three. And that's where I feel like I've done a really good job over the last few years, is in creating these little stepping stones that bridge the gap so that a player is always progressing and always learning a new habit. And not expected to make this quantum leap from form shooting to a game situation where they can't apply.
So a player really has to be all in and devoted and committed to this process, because it takes time.
Yeah, I don't do anything. I'm a passenger in this. I'm the guy sitting in the passenger seat with the map or the GPS, saying, "Okay, up here you're going to have to turn, and watch your speed." Like I'm the navigator. They are the driver, and if the player isn't willing to be the driver, or they think I'm the driver, it's probably not going to work at all, or at best, it's going to have marginal success. They need to really start to understand, okay, if we're doing this, it's because you are going to do this. I'm not going to teach you. You're going to have to learn. And that's why young players really struggle. They don't always have the maturity to grasp. They think that the coach's words are going to do something magical, and they don't. The improvement comes from the work that they do.
So as you're working on their grip, are you also trying to, you know, put out some pointers about their feet and balance, or are you perfecting grip and then moving on to feet and other facets of the shot?
That's a tough one. And I think that's where experience really comes in, is you want to try and get as many things working for the player as you possibly can, but nobody's ever going to do that perfectly. And so you're trying to figure out, okay, well, what can I live with? What can I allow the player to be comfortable with? And how much, if they only have a certain amount of bandwidth to be able to focus on this one problem that's the most pressing problem for them, how much bandwidth can they allocate to secondary problems or problems further down the list? And you're always just trying to figure that equation out, and there's no one set answer on it. It really depends on the player, their habits, the amount of time that they have, and the amount of focus they're willing to give to it. So tough to answer that one with a definite answer.
At what point do you ever see somebody with poor mechanics that has just worked so hard that they get pretty good at shooting? And if so, at what point do you just let it ride and maybe try to tweak one thing here or there, but understand that they put in so many reps that breaking down the shot and starting over wouldn't be beneficial?
Right. I think that's a large part of what we do. It's always an argument that's going on in the back of my head. Like, how much time do we have? What is the potential payoff? What is the risk? And is the risk worth the payoff? And so when a player gets to the point where they have something funky going on with their shot, but they've mastered their own shot, it also depends on what's your definition of mastery. If they're consistently a 40% three-point shooter and consistently an 85-plus free throw shooter, I don't care if you turn your back to the basket and throw the ball up over your head. If you can get those percentages, do it however you want. But if you're somebody who your definition of mastery is you mastered your own shot, but now you're only a 70% free throw shooter and you're shooting 33% from three, that's not mastery. And there's still potential that can be unlocked from that. And it's really just a matter of identifying the correct bad habits, isolating it for a little while, and learning how to change the habit. Sometimes that ends up being really, really hard. And sometimes it can be relatively easy, and you just don't really know until you get started.
So, I think, a perfect example, and I haven't really studied his shot, but, Reggie Miller comes to mind. You know,
right.
I don't know. It doesn't look normal. It looks like the mechanics are a little unique, but obviously one of the best shooters ever.
Right. And so at that point, I say, hey, Reggie, shoot the ball whenever you're open.
And, good advice.
Or heck, whenever you can get a shot off at the percentages of the teammate. He's demonstrated mastery. And it's not for me to say what is technically perfect, or it's like he's the definition of the level we're all trying to get these other people to. If you're already there, again, I don't care how you do it. just make shots. And but if you're not there, or you're playing at a lower level, and we believe that that moving up a level is going to expose some weaknesses, well, then maybe we need to change. So the player who is a 40% three-point shooter in high school but has sort of a funky shot, when that game speeds up in college, or if they make it to the pros, are they still going to be able to execute that shot in a faster setting and get results? You don't know, but you have to take an educated guess on what you think is best for that particular athlete.
All right, so when you are working with a master, somebody who's mastered shooting, what are you trying to do there? Is it more maintenance? I know you said you still start with form shooting.
The funny part is, I that's not a world that I live in. I don't get to work with those guys. Shooting coaches don't, in my mind, and this is only my definition, this isn't the correct definition, this is just my definition, I don't think shooting coaches should be working with those guys. Player development coaches should be, but I'm maybe even more specialty than a specialty coach. So in my mind, my job is to take the weak shooters and make them better. Like, take somebody who's terrible and make them below average, or take somebody who's below average and help them become average, or hopefully above average. Those are the players that I think the shooting coach needs to work with, as opposed to like everybody would always say when I work for the Phoenix Suns, hey, you're working with Steve Nash. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm clapping on the sidelines and saying, great shot, Steve. Steve Nash doesn't need to work with the shooting coach. I need to be working with the players that struggle to make shots. That's where my value comes in.
Was Nash the best shooter that you've been around?
I think Chip Englund is actually the best shooter I've been around, but Nash is definitely in that same category. And it might just be a bias that is leaning me towards Chip. Like the example I always give is Steve. I was rebounding for him one day just while he's shooting free throws, and I'm looking up at the net as each shot swishes through, and the netting made the same shape on every shot. And now if I swish two shots in a row, the swishes are going to be different. There's going to be one that's a little bit later in the hoop, and it's sort of, those are the ones that catch in the net and roll back to the player, but then there'll be other ones that sort of are early on in the hoop, and those are the ones that keep on sliding through and bouncing through the baseline. Steve's shots all swished the same. And even when he released a shot and made a sort of an audible, shoot, like he knew he missed it, or he knew he shot a bad shot, those still swished. And so, like, when I shoot a bad shot, I usually miss it. Steve still swishes.
Is that something, so if you're working with somebody and you get them to the point where they're pretty good, now are you starting to pay attention to how they make their shots?
That's a good question. Maybe not in that way, but I do pay a lot of attention to what I call their ball flight. Like, how does the ball react to their hand? What does the ball flight look like? Like, I end up thinking about things in a golf setting a fair amount. Like, what is your trajectory? Can you control the ball flight of the ball? Is your big miss a flat shot? Do you consistently miss left? Those are the things that I'll be looking at. Does the ball not spin purely? Okay. Why is that important? And how do we make that happen? Like, those are the things that I'll be watching.
Gotcha. Are you a believer in reps or going game speed?
I'm a believer in reps so that one day you're capable of going game speed. And I think, though, that's where those stepping stones that I talked about. If you're making a fundamental mistake that doesn't come off, cause the ball to come off the hand, your hand consistently, then we need to first slow things down and do the reps needed to break that habit. And and then slowly build it up so that you are capable of executing it one time in a random setting at game speed. Like, that's sort of the ultimate goal, but I don't think you jump right there.
Gotcha. Shooting off the dribble, are you going to different what are some techniques that you try to teach guys once they move to shooting off the bounce?
The two biggest ones, I want to really make sure that the player is on as solid a balance, solid in their balance as they can possibly be, understanding that they're not totally in control of the situation. Like, once you're shooting off the dribble, the defender is playing a much larger role in how well you shoot this ball than an open catch and shoot. So we need to sort of acknowledge that and do as much preparation as we can with our balance to be able to fight that fight. And then the other part that I think is really overlooked that I'll spend a lot of time on is just gathering that dribble, like controlling the dribble so that when you pick it up, you're as close to a shooting grip as you can be, and you're not having to make the adjustments from the time you pick up the dribble to your set point, your release point. We're hopefully practiced enough in picking up that dribble that as soon as it's in your hand, you're really close to a shooting grip already.
So are you almost wanting them to pound their last dribble into their shooting pocket if you can?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and just learning, like, we'll spend reps upon reps of just catching that cleanly. A lot of times starting just stationary and pound dribble into a clean catch in a shooting grip. And we'll do that over and over and over again. I've had a player who is the number one player in a draft, number one NBA pick, and it took him 15 dribbles to be able to catch it once in a shooting grip without bobbling it. And that's a reality. Like, it's hard to do. That's why shooting off the dribble is such a challenge, or part of why shooting off the dribble is such a challenge. And I think it gets overlooked by a lot of people, just the fact that, hey, we need to practice that little skill within the skill.
What about your feet? Are you like a believer in 1-2 step every time? Do you like to catch off 2 feet? Do you have a preference? You want them to be able to do both?
I don't have a preference on the footwork into the shot. I only prefer that a player is on balance and pushing evenly with their legs. So if you have time, I encourage a player, if you're open, I don't care what footwork you use. I want the ball to go in the basket. That's what we get points for. And so if you have time, do whatever you're comfortable with. But in practice, be able to have at least a base comfort level with all these different footworks, whether it's right or wrong. There are going to be situations where you're going to come off a curl cut, which I think should be an inside-outside 1-2 step. But things are going to happen within this game, and maybe you need to go outside-inside. And so do you have a base comfort with that? And I think it's also my role as a player development coach to prepare players for what the head coach wants. And ultimately, the head coach is going to dictate how much they care about footwork in those settings, which I think is more of a college thing. And then it's my job to be able to prepare the players to execute execute what the head coach wants.
Do you teach
and then if I can add in another layer, like, and also prepare them for the potential of what the next head coach in their career is also going to want. Like, I have to serve the player as well.
Do you teach a fadeaway?
It's a reality. Anytime I teach a fadeaway, I'm probably encouraging the smallest fadeaway that I probably can. So I don't do a ton of it. But when I do, it would be, because realistically, by the time a player is at the level where they're working on a fadeaway, they probably started working with the player development coach more so than the shooting coach, and I'm off working with the next shooter that needs to develop. But to answer your question, when I'm teaching a fadeaway, yeah, I would probably encourage as big a step back and as little a fade as possible and try and make it as close to that template of a non-fading shot as you possibly can.
Yeah, because I know you mentioned you want them jumping off both feet evenly. Is that
right?
Is that still possible in a fadeaway? I guess that's why you want a less of a fade and more of a step back.
Right. Yeah. And so all of these habits that we're trying to develop are to, we don't want to relinquish the fight to the defender, because it is a fight. They're trying to get you as off balance as they can, make your shot as complicated as they can. You need to be fighting as a shooter equally hard to keep it as simple as you possibly can. And if you're not, then the defense is going to win. And so that defense is going to win some of the battles where they're going to get you off balance, and you're going to shoot a fadeaway where you push unevenly and you land exclusively on one foot. And while I don't think it's technically perfect, it's a reality. I just hope that within that little battle, you are still fighting to keep the shot as simple as you possibly can. And if you're able to land 60% of your weight on one foot and 40 on the other, that's better than 80-20. And so theoretically, you have a better chance of making that shot.
I love that terminology. Don't relinquish the fight. Is that what you said?
It's something along those lines. Like, it's a battle.
It is.
If you're, I talk about like you're being a, who's the puppet master here? Is the defender pulling the strings? Because if they are, you don't stand a chance as a shooter. But if you're the one who's pulling the strings and dictating and fighting, then you have a chance.
Do you do a lot of film work with your guys?
I don't do a ton of film, and it really depends on the player. I had one player that as soon as he saw me pull out the iPad, he rolled his eyes, and he finally said to me, just tell me. Like, I trust you. I don't need to see it. Just tell me. So he didn't need to process things that way. But there are other people that when they see it, that speaks louder than any of your words. So it really depends on the individual. And when I watch film, the things that I'm talking about are the details end up being so small, and you're never going to be perfect with them, that you can end up really nitpicking a player that shot a pretty good shot, and you're going to say, if we watch it frame by frame, look at all these errors. Well, nobody ever shoots a perfect shot, and pretty good is usually pretty good. So we're going to practice to have as solid a habit as we possibly can, and then we're just going to go out into this imperfect world of a game and try and execute it as best we can.
I like that. What about floaters? Do you work on those? Do you teach floaters?
That's sort of the next area of the game that I really want to get into. I do a little bit. It's not what I do best, but it's sort of my next area that I want to improve as a coach. So there's right. Something specific you want to.
Well, what are you wrapping? Because I got to be honest, I have no idea how to teach a floater. You know, I like our guards to be able to shoot them. So sometimes I'll mix it into a workout, but I won't really give them specific instruction. But you know, the thing I see on TV a lot, you know, when you watch guys who are really good at it, are they really following through with their wrist? Are they flicking their wrist, or are they just kind of lofting it up there? Is the rotation the same? I mean, what are some of the things you're wrapping your head around when you're thinking about it?
Well, you just hit on the biggest thing that I am trying to wrap my head around. And I don't love sort of the dead hand knuckleball floater that players will shoot, because I believe the accuracy, your hand is basically making this the shape of the basketball. And as you snap your wrist, the shape of your hand is going to funnel the ball to the index finger or whatever the finger is on the middle of the ball. And if you can funnel it to that point, you will consistently hit that point, and you have a chance for the ball to go online much more consistently. If you're shooting a dead ball with no wrist snap, if you push slightly more with your thumb as a right-handed shooter, the ball is going way left. And if you push slightly more with your pinky, then the ball is going way way left. Did I say thumb would push it right, pinky would push it left.
Right.
And so there is no funneling motion that happens, and you're really at the will. And I've seen some players with some pretty good touch around the rim, and they try and shoot the dead ball floater, and they think, oh, I'll get that out of my hand faster. But they have no control, and some shots end up going really strange directions. And I think if they could just get not a full wrist snap like you would on a jumper, but even just like a half or a quarter of a wrist snap, just so there is some sort of a funneling motion, you get the ball coming out much more consistently. And the advice that I keep remembering is when bringing up this sort of a question to my mentor, he said, well, it's a shot. And really, that's as simple as we need to keep it sometimes. It's, hey, make a shooting motion. It doesn't need to be a weird shot putting. We don't control shot puts very well, but we've proven that we can control a shooting motion, so shoot it.
How much do you know how much Chip worked with? Because, like, Tony Parker, one of the best, to me, one of the best at shooting floaters maybe ever. How involved was he with that? Do you know?
I don't know, and I don't feel like that's it would be my place to talk about that.
Sure.
Anyways, but I would imagine a lot.
Have you observed maybe him or Steve Nash, who had a great floater? Are those guys snapping their wrist and following through some?
When I look at Nash shooting those, most of them were, if you took a picture of him from his waist up, you would have no idea if that was a runner, a floater, or a shot. Like, they all looked the same from the waist up. And I don't know if he's conscious about that. There were some things that I asked him on occasion, and I was surprised how, I don't want to say unconscious, because that makes it sound like it's bad connotation, or it has a bad connotation to it, but it was just like a natural thing that he did. And he just happened to naturally do it really fundamentally sound or really perfectly in a coach's mind. So, but it wasn't a conscious thing for him. So on that particular one, I don't know how conscious it was for him.
But in your mind, if you're teaching the floater and someone wants to take a picture of your students, you'd want that same thing. You wouldn't want to know whether that's a runner, a floater, or a three. You want it all to look the
same.
Yeah,
in a vacuum, that's kind of what I'd be shooting for. So, and ideally, that's like, it's a game and we don't control it. So there are going to be variables that where bad shots happen and you have to make a split decision. And I mean, I've switched the ball to my left hand to shoot it. Why I did that, it felt right in the moment. And so the weird things like that happen. But, yeah, ultimately we're just trying to keep it as simple as we possibly can. And one shot that we apply in different settings will be easier than having a whole bunch of different shots.
I know I'm taking up a bunch of your time, but I'm curious. Do you work on offhand shots? Is that something you do? Or
no.
No.
No, I the only time with one player I did, only because it was Tristan Thompson, who moved from left-handed to right-handed. So for a period of time, everything was his old offhand, his new shooting hand. But no, I especially again with the players that I end up working with who are the weaker shooters, I'd rather you start to master one hand before we worry about being average at two of them around the rim. Then you got to be creative and you got to be able to just sometimes just get the ball up on the rim with your non-dominant hand, but. Once we get outside of that 7 or 8 foot semicircle, everything would be dominant hand.
All right. Well, Dave, this has been great stuff. I really appreciate it. Tell us if people are interested in learning more, how can they find you on www.coachdavelove.com, and what are some things they can find there?
On my website, CoachDaveLove.com, I've got a newsletter that you can subscribe to where at least once a week, if not more, I just put out a shooting tidbit. And usually it ends up being, you know, 3 or 4 sentences or paragraphs on just a really specific part of the shot. And some of them will be really technical. Some of them will be more philosophical. And I've got great feedback on that. So that's a free newsletter that I provide. And I try and avoid fluff at all costs, and just really make it an intensive teaching situation. And then social media on top of that at Coach Dave Love on Instagram and Twitter, again, trying to provide tidbits or shooting advice to get conversations going. And I try and be as active as I can on that to help out coaches.
Can I ask one more question? Do you have time?
Of course. Yeah.
What is some of the things that you see where you just say that, man, colleges have it wrong? You know, the difference between the pro game and the college game, is there something college coaches in general, obviously we're speaking in generalities here, but when you get kids from that level, from the college level, just getting to the pro game, what are some of the things that you say, can't believe they haven't mastered this or worked on this?
This is an organization's fault and probably a reality, and I have no business to say whether it's right or wrong, but I'm disappointed by how little time the American college system players actually get to work with coaches and develop. And I say that only because I came from the Canadian system where if I wanted to spend 23 hours a day working with an individual player, I could. And so it's frustrating for me that college coaches want to do all this great work and aren't allowed to. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but I think everybody's doing the best they can. I think everybody does a great job within the time allowed. It would just be nice if there were more time allowed. But then at the same time, we've got the argument they're student athletes. They're not just athletes, and that's a valid argument as well. So that's why I don't claim to have all the answers. But
absolutely. Well, you had a lot of answers today, Coach. We appreciate it. Thanks so much, CoachDaveLove.com, and thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I had a great time chatting with you.